Welcome back to the Sexual Healing Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Pookie. And on this show, we get into life and all the crap that happens between the top of your head down to the bottom of your feet, but also from cradle to grave. So this week, this is episode 50, and because Father's Day just passed, I thought we'd talk about fathers and sons and that thing that often comes up between fathers and sons, forgiveness. So, before we dive into that too deeply, let's do a little opening bit and see where we go. First up is, we do have a hashtag now that we're using. It is hashtag Sexual Healing Pod. So if you are live tweeting while listening or have a comment, please use that hashtag Sexual Healing Pod. And also, because I often forget to do this, I want to say thanks to all the subscribers out there, the raters of the show. iTunes is definitely the preferred rating destination, I guess. That's where 70% of the folks go to get their podcasting information. So those of you that are using iTunes, we appreciate you. Although I don't know what Apple's going to do when they get rid of iTunes, but hey, not my issue, not my ministry. And also to the reviewers, I appreciate the feedback you've given on the show, whether it be on iTunes or in messages that have been sent to me. You are appreciated. And finally, to the folks that share the show and tell friends about it and share the content, but also, I keep forgetting folks, last but not least, the people that interact with me, that send in letters, that send in questions, that engage me in conversation online. Your time and willingness to do that is much appreciated, and I love you for it, because it's helping me to become a better podcaster, at least I hope it is. But okay, so, moving on. I want to wish a belated Father's Day. The show does not come out on Sundays, so I'll issue a belated Father's Day to all the fathers out there, whether you be biological, through marriage, adoption, through just being that male figure in a child's life. And I guess, well, no, that's a daddy, so we'll leave that alone. We'll keep it clean. So for all those dads and father figures out there, wishing you the very best and letting you know that this brother appreciates the work you're putting in and the commitment that you've made, not only to yourself, but to your families. So, in the past week, since I last spoke with all of you, it's been interesting. I mentioned last week that I had a setback with my recovery from the ear infection that I had, and really not just the ear, it was holistic, infiltrated my skull and all that good stuff. I am doing better. They did diagnose a very likely reinfection, but this time pretty mild. It did take some of the wind out of my sails, so I did kind of sit my hot ass down and have kind of taken it easy, taken a lot of unscheduled naps, because typically if I'm not well, I'll sit down somewhere and I'll pass out anyway, and then wake up hopefully an hour later, sometimes 5 or 6 hours later, like I did Sunday evening. I called myself sitting down to sort through some paper and just declutter, you know, just get rid of some stuff that I just don't need anymore. And I never did set up the table to do that. I never did pick up the items. I said, I'm really feeling a little zonk, so I'm going to lie down for a bit. And about five and a half hours later, I woke up and said, well, I guess that didn't happen. So, you know, such is life. I will get through it all, and eventually I'll get to that paper and those books that are just dying for my attention. On the plus side, I did get some writing done. You know, when I just have nothing else to do, or I don't feel like doing much or going anywhere, I am more likely to write. So I actually wrote about 7,000 words this week. At my last tally, it's probably up to about 8,500 at this point, over the last 7 days. So I'm very proud of that. And I guess if I had set a 1,000-word goal for each day, I'd be dangerous. But we'll see if I get there. But speaking of being dangerous, one of my writing projects that just kind of evolved out of me being ill and the fact that it's been 6.5 months and I'm still not back to full strength and full health. I just, I couldn't hear for significant portions of time, so watching television was out, catching up on stuff like Game of Thrones or Frankie and Grace, just all, Westworld, all the stuff that I'm like, oh, I want to watch that. You really can't watch it if you can't hear. At least for me as a person who normally can hear, and I'm just kind of used to the full audio visual experience. So the subtitles were helpful, but I just couldn't read them and look at the faces and get the nuances. So watching television just was not very helpful and often frustrating. Even watching like a basketball game or a football game was frustrating at times because I couldn't hear the commentary. And so it's just kind of this out-of-body experience almost. So that project, my business partner kind of challenged me to getting our creative writing endeavors organized and by the end of the month to get something not exactly ready to publish, but at least organized. And I kind of took it as you need to have a draft of something, even if it's not publication ready. But apparently, his thoughts, and maybe he said it and I missed it, I don't know. His thoughts were just to have something outlined. And so I basically kind of took inventory of all the writing I've done while I was ill, particularly the writing I did while I was under the influence of various opioids, or opiates. I can never remember which one it is. I think it's opiates. And so I actually started cataloging that material, and I have about 12,000 words of material. So the idea that I got was to compile that stuff into a volume and release it as an ebook of some kind. And so I'm actually kind of excited about that. Not kind of excited. I am excited about that. So I am in the process of cataloging that and finally going in and editing that material, but I'm still transcribing some of it because at certain points, I really didn't feel like typing, so I would just write by hand. I recall the day that I was admitted to the hospital, I wrote quite a bit by hand that day while in the waiting room and at lunch. And then after that, I kind of went back in the waiting room, and then it was a blur when they took me in, and I ended up in a hospital bed. So, but I definitely. I'm looking forward to seeing what that looks like and figuring out the way forward in terms of artwork and trying to figure out how to format a document for publication on Kindle. So it'll be an ebook. So looking forward to that. I'll let you guys know where to get that and I'll probably advertise it as well, and just see if there's any interest in there in it. But certainly for me, it's been cathartic and I think getting ill was not just about, oh, I'm sick. It's also about I'm now a captive audience to myself, and it forced me to deal with some shit that I hadn't dealt with, that I knew was there, but just didn't deal with it. So it reinforced a lot of why I'm doing this show and why I appreciate the listeners that I have and the listeners to come and collaborators as well. I definitely want to talk to fellow podcasters and to other thought leaders and intriguing folk out there about either their work or stuff that's of interest to our community collectively. Because as I often say, I am a 40-something black male, same gender loving guy living in Southern California. So this is just my perspective on things, and I also happen to have a PhD in psychology. Though I don't officially counsel people and treat and do the clinical work, but the acumen's there. I just don't do it, at least not officially. So, in honor of Father's Day and all the fathers out there, I wanted to, as I guess a lot of people do this time of year, is reflect on their fathers, and I want to reflect on mine. And it My father was, I often say he was a very complex and paradoxical kind of guy because there were these various sides to him that were, they ran the gamut. When he was really good and just like that loving man and father, he was pretty damn good at it. But more often than not, he was not so good at it and downright terrible. So when I think about happy memories of my dad, one that comes to mind, he was a big Laker fan. So he bought like a Lakers bomber jacket and he had it embroidered on, it was a reversible jacket. So the one layer, one side of it was like black with purple lettering, I believe, or gold lettering, and then a purple Lakers emblem on the other breast. And he had his name embroiled on it, and his nickname was Ace, and so that's what he had on there. And on the other side, which was the yellow side of the jacket, he had Lil Ace embroidered on there, which was what he and a lot of his friends would call me, because a lot of his friends called him Ace, and so I was Lil Ace, even though at that point I was probably about a half inch taller than him, but I was still his son, so I was younger. And so he was Big Ace and I was Lil Ace. And so I just remember when he kind of came down the stairs one day and I was washing dishes and he called me into the living room. And I came out and he had this jacket on. He's like, "What do you think? You like it?" And I say, "Yeah, it's cool." I wasn't big into fashion back then. I would say now, I was like, "Oh, that's a bad jacket. I like it," And he was like, "Here, try it on." And so, and at the time, we were basically about the same size. I was probably a little broader than him, but And I was in 7th or 8th grade at this point, I believe. And he kind of, as he was taking the jacket off, he kind of reversed it and he kind of put it on me. And he's like, "Looks like a good fit." And I went and looked at it in the mirror. I had to go up the stairs, though, to see the mirror. I don't remember any mirrors downstairs. And I looked in the mirror and saw that he had embroidered my name on it. And it was very heartwarming because at that point in my life, I did not feel like I was the son that my father wanted in many regards. We just had a very strained relationship where he was trying to figure out how to be a dad, which on its own is tough enough, but when you're also dealing with a traumatized adolescent that really won't open up to you about what's going on with him, and he's just worried about his mother because she's gone at the time. It was tough. I didn't make it easy for him to parent me at that time. At the same time, I think even if I had, it would have been a struggle for him because we just didn't click in many regards. The funny thing is that it's odd because when I look in the mirror, at a certain point in my life, I would look in the mirror and I'd see him. And it was just really odd because I said, "Well, I guess I do look like the guy after all." I grew up being called Lil Ace and being told I look like my dad, and people would see me after a number of years and say, "Oh God, you look like your daddy." And it was just always strange because there were points in my life where I really did not like the man at all. I loved him as my father, but as a person, I did not like him. So that was really challenging. And so when I think about, those happy memories, each of my bachelor's, when I got my bachelor's degree, he was the first person that I saw when I walked off the stage, after they announced my name, and I came across and shook all the hands and hugged one of my professors. He was the first person that I saw, and it was really happy moment to kind of come down the stairs and get a big hug from him and a kiss on the mouth, because that was his way. He hadn't done that in years, but he was like, "This is an occasion. I don't care how old you are. I'm kissing you on your mouth because you're my child." And so that's what he did. And it was really cool. And also with my doctoral graduation, that one was a big one. The whole family flew to Ohio for that ceremony. Well, a lot of the family flew, not everybody, but a lot of the family flew over, and My grandmother told him, because at the time his substance abuse issues were pretty severe, and my grandmother said to him, if you can stay sober for 3 months at least, then I will cover you on this trip, because he didn't have the resources to get there. Although I guess he probably did, knowing him. Dad was a hustler. He made shit happen. Wasn't always legal, but he made stuff happen. And he actually sobered up and he came, and it was just, it was like that culture shock of seeing all these people in a place that I had never seen them before. Like, there was just the me that was over there and was a student and was doing my thing, and I had my own apartment, and it was just this life. I was a graduate student, aka a slave. And then to see all these people that are reminders of home show up there was just very interesting for me. And so the graduation ceremony was interesting, to say the least. One of these days I may talk about it in more detail, but I'll just say that again, when I came across the I'll call it a chancel, because it wasn't a stage. It was mobile, and so it was not this big thing. It was an outdoor ceremony, luckily on a decent weather day, because those black robes were rough, and it was maybe 80 degrees that day and not too humid. We appreciated that, because it was 94 the day before and it was just brutal. And so it was really cool to see him down on one knee snapping pictures, because he always took pictures, and we'd sit around and go through the photo albums, and he'd tell me stories about the people. And oftentimes the stories were really not appropriate for a child's ears, but that was my father's crew. They partied hard, they lived hard. In many cases, they fucked hard, and it was who they were, And so I look back on a lot of them like, oh God, I grew up with stuff and knew stuff that I should not have known, and called people uncle and auntie that I should, that I suspect that people would have called, what is it, Child Protective Services, had they known I was associating with such folk. Because the reality was, at my dad, as I said, was a hustler, and he dealt drugs at a certain point. He did a little bit of pimping on the side, and he was the life of the party. So Ace had a party every weekend, seemingly. And if I was visiting and staying with him, I was in the middle of said party, because I was his main man. And he wasn't that type of dad that would send you to bed and be like, you can't see this. I mean, certainly he would check people if they got completely out of control. Like one time, one of his friends got drunk and started stripping, and he was, and I don't, yeah, actually, he stripped down to the socks before anybody said anything, because we were all just sitting there like, why is this man taking his clothes off? And the stripper had got him turned on, and Miss Red had put it on him, so he decided he was gonna get his drunk ass up and start stripping, and it was a lot. And I just said, sir, I did not need to see all of that from you. It just was so inappropriate. But that was life, in the House of Ace. And so my doctoral graduation was really cool, because he was there. And in many respects, even though our relationship was very dysfunctional at that point, he was one of those people and things that kind of propelled me through, because doctoral study is a motherfucker. It's those of us that have done it, we can all look at one another like, And it's hard to explain to people why the shit was so hard, and just know that it takes over your life, and you're really in this fucked up limbo, because you're a student, but you're expected to function a lot like the faculty, because that's what they're training you to become, but you don't get any of the faculty money. As a grad student, I was getting by on maybe, I think maybe $9,600 a year. Yeah, at my height, maybe about $10,200. Because there was no time to work a job. I was at a Research One institution where it's all about publish or perish, not just for the faculty, but for the students as well. So it was, we were busy. I was driving between Ohio, Northwest Ohio, and Detroit a couple times a month conducting research because that's what we're expected to do. So it was interesting that the person that in many respects did not give me what I had hoped to get from him to help me get through that was very pivotal in me getting through that experience nonetheless, because I just kind of looked at his life and said, I don't want this for myself. I don't want that. I do want this. I do want that. And it was interesting. So, yeah, and interesting is a loaded word for me in this context. It's hard to put into words, but I think about some of the not so happy moments and memories of him being shot on an occasion at a Christmas party when he was supposed to be at work. Instead, he was at a party in Compton and cutting up, and somebody, was, I guess, talking. No, actually, no. His little piece at the time was scheming and I guess trying to make his ex look jealous. I don't know, but somehow my dad got in the middle of it and he got 5 bullets for his trouble. Didn't kill him. You couldn't take him out that easily. There were times where he was just drunk beyond comprehension, and he was a mean drunk. I was every kind of pejorative word under the sun when he was drunk. Got hit, more than once, I'll just say that. So there was assault and abuse there as well, which are things that I've come to recognize as that. I didn't see them that way growing up. It was just life. And I certainly look at my life and the things I have experienced and the traumas that are there that I'm dealing with now. I never really saw it as just this terrible thing. I think because so many things were normalized around me that I just didn't see it that way. And it was interesting because in a conversation with my minister about 7 years ago now, which is kind of like, wow, she and I were talking, and I just kind of shared a story with her about something because I had said something interesting, and she got a big chuckle out of it. And she said, "Where did that, where did you get that from? The way you said that and that whole experience, is that a real story?" And I said, "Oh yeah, that happened." And so of course I get into a conversation about my father and just some of the things, and she just kind of, her face went from a very broad smile of laughter. It gradually went into just this look of great concern. And she just kind of said to me, she's like, I don't want you to take this the wrong way. And I said, what? And she said, what you're describing is, that is tantamount to abuse. And I said, no. And she said, yeah. And it was just interesting. I'm arguing with my minister about whether my relationship with my father was abusive. And I really never put it in those terms. But in the process of going through therapy and kind of breaking down a bit at a certain point where I wasn't running from stuff, and after some failed relationships and not being available to various men, I realized, like, okay, maybe something's wrong with me. It's possible. And so it was interesting. And so I think I kind of really didn't take her statement to heart for maybe another year. And then that's when just all hell broke loose, and I just realized, like, oh my gosh, there's trying to separate, these really hilarious memories, the stories I could tell about my father and the shenanigans and his crew, and then the things I learned about him when he was very ill and ultimately when he died, and just it probably could burn some folks' hair off their head. And yet it's not atypical for a lot of us, I'm sure. I have to think that our parents, they are decidedly human. They all have their warts. They all have their regrets and their things they wish they had done differently or not done at all. And so I don't share these things necessarily to bash my father, but just to speak the truth of it, because he's one of the reasons I'm doing this show, because I realize that I have a lot to say, as you're probably well aware, and there are a lot of us out there that are hurting because of things that happened in our childhood, whether it was gross negligence and abusiveness on the part of our parents, or just inadvertent, or just, the vice grip of poverty and growing up with uncertainty about where are we going to live, where's the next meal coming from dealing with extended family. We keep, as a people, as a black folk, as an African American, descendants of Africa, we keep a lot of stories within ourselves, and those stories have the potential to completely eat us from the inside out. And so I really try not to be Eon LaVanzant, but I do feel like for us to heal from whatever it is that ails us, we've got to be able to call it out and see what it is. Call a thing, as she likes to say, and go about doing that work. And so for me, my father's passing was very traumatizing, more so than I gave it, I guess, the weight that it deserved at the time. I was out of town in Detroit, surprisingly enough, and this was about 3 years after I graduated with my doctoral degree, and I was back home. I was a working professional, and I was away on business, and before I left, I put him in hospice care because he was on a ventilator. He basically was, as they told me, he was brain dead. His brain activity was minimal. He was, cascading organ failure was in his near future. I did not think he would necessarily die before I left. Or die while I was away, but he did. He died the day I left, actually. And I just remember landing in Detroit and getting my rental car and turning on my phone because I forgot to turn it back on. And this was in the days where you really had to turn off your cell phone while flying because, it was serious. And I had just a ton of messages. And basically, it was relatives saying, "Hey, where are you? You got to come back. He's not doing well." And I basically just did not go back. I did not go back. I could not go back. He and I had talked about that, and he had told me to go about my life. He had lived his. It was time for me to live mine. And so I did what I thought was best for him and in accordance with his wishes, even in terms of taking him off of life support, and letting him sink or swim, which is what he wanted. It was a hard decision. I think to this day, it still haunts me in some regards, in ways that I probably don't even realize. But I think about it in terms of just that was his life. And our lives intertwined for a period of time, and then they separated. And I now have memories and echoes of him at this point. He's no longer physically with me, but I hear him in my head often. We have the same laugh, we have very similar senses of humor, very raunchy, very verbose. We are liable to say any damn thing at any time. Certainly, when I'm in Dr. Pookie mode, I'm definitely much less thoughtful about the things I might say. I'm definitely un-PC. Dr. Pookie is very un-PC. And yet, he's very Intelli Ratchet. So, yeah, so you definitely get slices of my father. We didn't have the whole thing of him having to react to handling, or raising a gay son. My father, I would probably classify him, if I had to, as pansexual. I just, based on what I saw, the company he kept, I would venture a guess that at the very least, he is bisexual, having been married to four different women, and I would say at, you know, in the more liberal sense, he might classify, I would probably say he's pansexual. And it's not to say that I saw him engaged in activity with people that would be gender nonconforming or anything like that, but just, again, the company you keep, the circles you run in, I have to think that at some point, I'm sure he was engaged in some activity with someone that would not identify as male or female. So, yeah. And Dad was wild that way. He was a free spirit in some regards. In other regards, he was very buttoned up, and that's kind of what I think what killed him, ultimately. Just this idea of not being able to be fully who he is and having that freedom. And so I kind of mourn his departure, but I also mourn the pain that he had to have gone through that drove him to drink excessively till he wiped out his liver, to drink to the point of, you know, basically decimating his kidneys, and some other things that caused acute trauma to his body that he just never recovered from. So Father's Day is always tough for me because my father died on June 4th, and it's right around the corner from Father's Day. So I'm typically in a pretty sour mood on June 4th, that might start on June 3rd. The first couple of years after he died, I knew why. And for the next 10 years or so, I gradually forgot why I was in such a bad mood on those days, where I'd maybe realize at 6 o'clock that evening, oh, that's why I'm in such a crappy mood. And then it would be maybe a day later in the subsequent years. And even this year, June 4th came and went, and it just did not register. I am certain that on some level I felt that sense of loss and there was some grief there, but I just didn't have enough bandwidth to allocate to it to really register and hit me that hard. But I'm sure that it hit me. I just, because I'm trying to get myself back together still. And I'm overhauling my business and how it works, and there's just a lot going on with me right now. But certainly Father's Day itself kind of threw me for a loop. It's not a holiday that I'm thrilled about, because my father and I, we had such a challenging relationship, I guess is a good way to put it. And so I think the thing that, you know, looking and kind of morphing into the main topic for today, I thought we'd talk about forgiveness. Because I think a lot of us, we have our issues with our fathers, and love them or hate them, the issues are the issues. And so for me, it really has been a process of forgiveness. And it's something that my therapists have told me over the years. I think the first therapist to tell me was probably when I was still in school, and I was a senior in undergrad, and she said to me, what's your relationship like with your parents? And I said, well, Mom is great. You know, we had some years where it was, you know, because she was struggling with substance abuse issues herself. And it was just a lot of grieving there and a lot of anxiety for me. Like, is my mom okay? Where is she? I said, but we're great now and we're getting better. And she's like, and your father? And I said, yeah. I said, yeah, there's a whole lot of shit there. And I said to her, I said, you know, I love the guy. I just don't know what to do with him sometimes. And that's where we jumped off. And just this idea of perfectionism and imposter phenomenon, and we kind of got into a discussion of where that stuff comes from, because I instantly liked her when I first met her, and she did like a brief talk at our Black student retreat about that, and she said a lot of it comes from this idea that we don't think we're good enough, and it's not an objective assessment, it's just the little kid in you that is like, I didn't get this, or I didn't get that, or I didn't feel as secure as I would have liked, or as I needed to as a child. And she said, it's not universal. She's like, you can't just blame that on all your problems. She's like, but if you do have certain issues, certain responses to things that you cannot understand, you may want to look at that. And I'm in my office. My staff is here. If you need to talk with us, we're here for you. And so I just remember her saying that, and it just kind of opened up the door a little bit. And then grad school brought up all kinds of traumatic issues. My neighbors are so damn loud. And it just brought up all my man issues and just daddy issues. And I was like, oh my God. And so, as a working professional, certain things came to a head, and I just said, okay, I need to deal with some of this shit because it's really kind of throwing my life off track here. So, a big part of that was forgiveness. And, because I'm a psychologist, I kind of look at psychological models, so to speak, and I wanted to introduce to you, you've probably heard some of this before out and about, but the process model of forgiveness. There are two different models. One is the process model, which I'm going to walk through in a little more detail today, versus a decision model. And decision model is a much more internal, less structured process. It's just you kind of looking at life through a lens and realizing that you just kind of you change your mind about certain things, and you just, yeah, it's just you start to, yeah, you just change your mind about how you view things. You go from things being traumatic to maybe neutral or empowering, or you look at not just the bad stuff you got out of certain experiences, but also the good stuff that you gained. So that's the quick and dirty assessment of that decision model. But I want to talk about the process model because it has four stages of forgiveness. And the first stage is what we call the uncovering. And that's where you explore any past grievances or traumas and areas that need forgiveness. And this could also be any regrets you have about things that you've done or not done, and also disappointments about either with yourself or with other people. And so this forgiveness process is not just external. It also applies to you forgiving your own, applies to you forgiving yourself as well as any other person or persons that have hurt you in some way or done you in a way that you found to be problematic. So some of the, some of the key questions that you can kind of pose to yourself when looking at this idea of where did my thing go? My thing done disappeared on me, Lord. I'm not happy. I had notes on this. I had questions. Okay, here we go. So some of the questions that you might ask yourself in this uncovering phase, very simply, who hurt you? And how deeply were you hurt? But also looking at the circumstances at the time that you were hurt, looking at specific incidences where you may have been traumatized or hurt in some way or wronged. And just really asking yourself the questions, so just as the phase says with the uncovering, to uncover the nature of it, of what it is you are dealing with. How does, are you angry? How do you feel about it? How have you dealt with that anger? How does it manifest? Has it impacted your health? Have you developed any sort of obsession around this slight, or you were disappointed because you didn't respond to a certain thing this way? I can think of fights that I witnessed and felt like, I could have done more to prevent this fight, or I could have done more to help this person. I just remember in like 7th grade seeing a young lady that I thought was a friend of mine. Like, she was down the block and this other girl was just kicking the crap out of her, and she was down on her knees, and she basically was kind of bent forward a little bit, and the girl was just kicking her, trying to kick her in her chest and in her face, but she had her hands and her arms and elbows up there, kind of protecting her. And I just remember the bus driver, says it was a school bus back in the day, and she's like, "Get her off of her!" I kind of looked and I said, "What are you talking about?" I hadn't even gotten off the bus yet, actually, now I think about it. And then when I came around, got off the stairs and off the bus, I saw what was happening. And by then, some people had pulled her off, and I just remember being extremely traumatized and very disappointed in what I didn't do for her, even though it really wasn't up to me necessarily. Like, I shouldn't be taking on that weight on that level. And yet, I really did. And I just remember being very traumatized about that. I was in tears walking with my friends because that happened. And so there was a bit of obsession with me around that event, but also around some of the stuff that happened with my father. There's obsession. And also, if you were injured in some way, has that caused a permanent change in your life or changed your worldview? Certainly for me, trust is hard to come by in some regards. At least that most intimate level of trust that you would need to have to be in a relationship with a partner, that is where I struggle. It's a point of struggle for me, and I hate that it is, but it is. And that's why some relationships have not worked out for me. Although in some cases he wasn't the right man for me either. But that's another story. I know the perfect person to come on to talk about that, and I'm hoping to get him within the next couple of weeks. So the second phase of this forgiveness process model by Enright is the decision phase. And in the decision phase, that's when you actually examine the consequences of holding on to past hurts versus letting them go. So this is something that you often hear about, this idea of bitterness is like poison that's killing you from the inside, or holding resentment for someone is like drinking the poison and expecting it to kill them and not you. And that's really when you kind of have to, when you've uncovered all your traumas and all the things that you need to either forgive other people for or forgive yourself for, that's when you start looking at each of these things and saying, okay, well, what are the consequences of this? And does it benefit me more to hold on to how I feel about this or to let it go? And that's why they say forgiveness is not so much for the people you're forgiving, but for yourself. Because it really does make a huge difference in your life to forgive and to just let shit go, no matter how wronged you've been. But I also understand holding on because I look at something like the Central Park Five and what happened to those boys and now men, and the fact that their lives have been changed in ways that cannot be fixed. Obviously I've not sat down and talked with these gentlemen, but maybe they weren't the nicest of guys. It's possible. I don't know their histories in that way, but they were sent to prison for 13 years for something that they did not do. And I know I've seen some things about, well, it wasn't just the rape of this woman, it was all these other things. And I said, well, do we have incontrovertible evidence that these five boys committed those acts of violence either? And I don't think we do. So I always think about, have they been able to forgive? And what was their process? What did it take for them to let go of some of that bitterness and resentment, particularly of the prosecutor, because she's catching hell nowadays, as well she should, heffa. But ultimately, forgiveness is a decision. You have to decide to let it go. And once you've done that, you then go into the third phase, which Enright calls the work phase. And that's where you start working. It's a helping process where your thoughts, feelings, and images regarding, the forgiveness of the key issues. So that was butchered, my goodness. So basically what you're doing there is you're working toward understanding the person who harmed you, by viewing that person within a context. So you might think about the bully that beat the crap out of you or stole your money or spread rumors about you when you were in school. You can look at that person as just a really evil or horrible person, but as you get older and you get more information and you really sit back and get the story, you realize this person was having a crap beat out of them. It's, at home perhaps, or they were being bullied and the shit ran downhill. And it's not an excuse. It's just getting a better understanding of why what happened to you happened to you. I'm not saying you have to forgive people for the bullshit they've done to you, or forget, or just give them a pass. No, they've got to own the shit that they've done. But for you to forgive them and be able to move on, you've got to be able to let some of that go. You just can't hold on to it forever. But more importantly, the easier way for you to understand it and to honor your decision to let it go is to understand the full context of why it happened. I often think about the disappointments I have in myself, and because I didn't do this or I didn't do that, or why did I say this in this interview and why did I do that? And I have to understand I did the best that I could in the moment, or at least the best I believed I could do. And I have to forgive myself for the decisions that I made at the time and move forward. But more importantly, what can I take from that that'll help me going forward, that'll help me now and help me going forward? Hopefully I'll be able to do better, that the next time that opportunity arises or that decision comes up again, that maybe I'll be able to make a different decision than I did the last time, or I'll make the same decision, but I'll do it better, and maybe I'll have a different outcome. I think the other part is when you start to understand the full context of what has happened, you start to develop some compassion for the person that has harmed you. And I certainly look at that in the context of my father, recognizing, you know, did he make the best decisions in parenting me? Hell no. He just didn't. I'm not gonna hold on to that illusion at all. But I also recognize that he was not ready to be a dad at 18, even though he was doing the fucking that could result in that. He wasn't really ready for the job. Fortunately for me, my mother was. And then for a while, she wasn't capable of it. And then she came back. And she's been an awesome mom since. But I do have some compassion for my father, because I recognize that he, in trying to have a relationship with me, tried to correct some of the wrongs that happened in his relationship with his father. And I suspect that my grandfather had some relationships with him, you know, some relationship issues and things with his dad that he wanted to put in place in his relationship with my father, and they maybe didn't work out the way he expected. But I also look at the full context of my father's life and the pain that he was in, starting when he was 12 or 13 years old, and the time that he and mom created me, and then they did what they could to raise me. I look at that whole timeline, what I know of him and what I experienced of him, and a lot of what went on, I've been able to forgive it because I had to let it go, because it was destroying my life in some ways and really excuse me, manifesting in some really unpleasant ways in my body as well. But also I just couldn't live in that time anymore. When that shit happened, it happened a long time ago. It happened when I was 3 years old. It happened when I was 5, 6, 9, 11, 12, 13, 16, 21. You know, it happened at various times. And the reality is, I'm 46 now. I can't keep living stuff that happened when I was 5. It's traumatizing. It's painful. When I relive it in my head, or just, and I'll be in a quiet moment, it'll pop up, and the shit is really painful. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe he did that to me. I can't believe she did that. I can't believe these motherfuckers did this. All that stuff, it's not like forgiveness makes it go away. It just helps you to reshape it. And to be compassionate with yourself for whatever you did not, or whatever you did or didn't do at the moment that you thought may have made it better. You don't get to do hindsight on shit that's already happened to change the outcome of it. What you can change is how you perceive it. You can accept the pain that comes with it and learn and grow from it. And when you're able to do that, you're then able to give the people who have hurt you, that you're now forgiving, a gift. And, you know, some of the things say it's a moral gift. It could be monetary. It could be returning a favor. You know, I recall that when I got to the hospital, when my father was in really, really bad shape and was not going to be with us anymore, and my grandmother was talking to his doctor, and she was very, you know, she was in histrionics. She was very upset. Understandably, her baby was not well, and she saw that I was there, because it was just very surreal to me, just walking in, walking across this waiting room, and there are about 15, 20 relatives sitting there, and I'm just kind of like, hey, y'all, and just, it was very troubling. And going over to talk with his doctor, and I was asking his doctor, like, okay, well, what's his prognosis at this point? What's going on? And he said, well, you know, obviously he did some things that he was advised not to do, which has landed him here. He is in a coma. It's not good. His brain activity is minimal. It might be just brainstem making his heart beat, possibly making him breathe, but we had to intubate him. Otherwise, he was going to choke on his own blood and die at that point. So they had to tube him. And they're like, you know, he's on a machine. It's breathing for him. We don't know if what's going to happen if we take him off of it. And I said, well, are there any other tests that you need to run? And they said, well, we're going to do a pain response test to see if he's still in there. And if he is he at least cognizant of pain? Or is he just in a strictly vegetative state? And I said, okay, well, do I need to step out for that? And the doctor was like, no, you can come on in. I said, okay. So my grandmother and I, and I think my uncle, one of my uncles came in, and they basically they pressed on his eyes, and he responded to that. They, you know, did different pressure points on his body that if you're conscious, you're like, ow, like snatching away. And he was responsive. And so I said, well, doc, what's the probability of him waking up, and how severe is the brain damage? And they said, well, we can't say definitively, but prefrontal cortex is not really anything going on in there. It's damaged. And I said, okay. I said, what about sight, vision? You know, I was like, is he going to lose senses? And they said, possibly. And I said, okay. And so my grandmother, she left the room. She just couldn't handle hearing that. So I said to the doctor, I said, well, hey, let's give him 24 hours to wake up. And then we'll see if he doesn't wake up, let's take him off the vent. And if he's able to breathe on his own, he breathes on his own. If he doesn't, I got to say goodbye to him. And we gotta let him go. And my doctor was like, that's a very wise decision. Well, you know, that's a good way to go. So the reason I bring all that up is because when I stepped out of the room, my grandmother came up to me very angrily, and she accused me of punishing him by keeping him in a vegetative state. And which was just really, really, really hurtful to me. Because it never crossed my mind to do that. It was never this issue of, oh, this man has done this and this to me. You know, the time will come and I'm going to have my revenge. That was never part of it for me. It was very clear that my father's in a really bad place, and I don't know exactly what I can do to help him right now, but let's see if he's still in there. Let's see if he can breathe on his own. And we took him off, and he was breathing like a racehorse. And so I said, okay, well, does that mean he's just going to be like this? What's the story? And the doctor said, well, he's going to live. However, unless he wakes up, he's not protecting his airway. So he's going to eventually die, possibly of pneumonia or organ failure, because he's in bad shape. And I said, okay. I said, well, what's the next step? I said, what else can we do for him? And he's like, not a lot. He said, you can put him in hospice and they can keep him comfortable because we know that he's in pain. We know he's responding to pain. And I said, okay, well, then let's keep him comfortable. It's like, don't, he doesn't want to be, he does not want to wake up and not be himself. He said that to me very clearly. And so I just remember my grandmother just coming at me with all this fury about punishing him. And I was really, it was very, it was devastating. And I just remember having to really detach myself emotionally and say to her, Grandma, that's not what I'm doing. I said, we're gonna, it's like, we don't know if he's in there. He's in bad shape. He's in really, really bad shape. I'm giving him 24 hours to wake up. If he doesn't wake up, we'll take him off the vent. And we'll see what happens. I said, but I'm not keeping him alive just to keep him here to just lie there. That's not what he wants. I know that's not what he wants. So that's not what I'm going to do with him. And like I said, we took him off the vent the next day. He was breathing. I put him in hospice, and the next morning I was on a plane to Detroit, and he died at about 9:04 p.m. Pacific time. Yeah, it was 4 minutes after midnight when my uncle called to tell me that he had died. And I'm very happy that at that point I had forgiven him. We had had our come to Jesus talk. We had had our moment. We didn't get to hash everything out. There's a lot of shit I would have liked to have discussed with him. A lot of shit that he kept from me. Such as two wives that, I never met. Such as a half brother that could never be confirmed to be my half brother. And also just our issues between me and him. But I think through forgiveness and his passing, and it's been an ongoing process, I'm definitely in this deepening phase, as Enright calls it, which is the last phase of forgiveness, where you're finding meaning for yourself and others, in what happened, what it is that needs to be forgiven, and also in this process of forgiveness. And I'm better able to recognize when I needed forgiveness from other people. And I think that one of the things that I'm recognizing through this journey of being ill and slowly recovering and my life not being where I want it to be and shit not being where I want it to be and not being able to act as a very active and assertive agent to make things happen that I want to happen, more than anything, I'm learning that I'm not alone. Growing up, I felt often that I was alone in this, and folks weren't particularly concerned with my well-being. And it's a really frightening and lonely thought to have. That's a really fucked up way to go through life. So I'm very happy that I've been able to kind of move past that. And it's been in stages. I've not done the best. I've not done the best at all. I've definitely struggled in many regards with recognizing that I'm not alone, even though I've often felt that way. But I'm not. It's a fantasy for me to think that I'm alone and no one cares. People do care. They care a great deal. So it's been a process, and I think that's probably one of the biggest gifts that he has given to me. Is this idea that I'm not alone, that I have value beyond what I can even measure, and that I'm worthy of all the good stuff that's in life. For a long time, I didn't feel like I was because there was so much around me that was so atypical from everyone else. And it was just like, why is my life so fucked up? Why are the people around me so fucked up? And realizing that them and their issues didn't have anything to do with me. They really and truly did not have anything to do with me. They were circumstances, but they were not statements about who I was and what I was worthy of. So I think that I've realized, and they say here, you realize that the harm and the trauma and the things that you're having to forgive, they do have positive implications as well for you. It's not all bad. And then I'm noticing the catharsis, the emotional release, the decreased negative effect that it's having on my life, where I'm just a little happier. I'm not the joy of happy. I'm not the picture, like I'm not that person that you look at, I'm like, are you really that fucking happy all the time? I'm not that person. But I definitely am more apt to smile, and I'm not so deep in thought and just stuff that I'm trying to make sense out of, and trying to find a way forward that's affirming to me. I'm definitely in a better place. And I think when you think about emotional release, I think about some of my writing projects and, not just this one from when I'm ill, but I'm working on a project that I've tentatively titled The Trauma Chronicles, where I'm basically practicing forgiveness on paper. I'm kind of walking through this process of laying out major life traumas in a series of essays and short writings, talking about what happened, how I felt at the time, how it's impacted me, and reframing it into a more, certainly, not blowing smoke up my ass, but at least something more affirmative, as opposed to, oh yeah, well this happened to me because I ain't shit. That's fantasy. This happened to me because I just happened to be there, or this was the circumstance around me. It was beyond my control. I've experienced it this way. I didn't like it. I didn't like this person for doing it. Blah, 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 blah. But now I'm working through the process and recognizing that what happened to me had nothing to do with me per se. I just happened to be collateral damage for someone else's war. And that can be hard because you're just like, what did I do to deserve this? And sometimes the answer simply is nothing. You were breathing. Nothing. You were there. And sometimes that's enough. And the consequences come calling. So I'm hoping that, this very quick run through some of my experiences with my father and looking at father-son relationships and this process of forgiveness. I'll be sure to post some of these materials in the show notes. Will help you to kind of understand and maybe reframe some of the things that have happened to you, how you've lived with those things over the years, how they've shaped you, possibly to the negative, but also looking at how you can take those things that have been unfortunate that have happened to you and make them a positive. Okay. So I'm going to take a short break here before returning with listener letters and closing out this episode. Okay, and now we're back and we're going to be getting into our listener letters for the week. Let's see here. Oh, I didn't get to any of that stuff, but I'm not going to do it today either. So today, the letters that I have are basically around our theme of fathers and sons. So the first one is from a gentleman that I've named Chris. And Chris writes, I have a 17-year-old son, and I'm pretty sure he is gay. He is not out to me, although I don't know if he might be out to any of his friends. It's frustrating to be on the outside looking in because I see him dealing with the confusion and anxiety that comes with being a teen. But I only know my experience as a straight guy. Because it can be really hard for kids to come out, I have to think that it's even crazier for him than it was for me. That shit was crazy as hell. I'm sure it was, Chris. I love my son and I want to be as supportive for him as possible. However, I don't want to confront him and make it seem like I'm trying to pull him out of the closet. What advice do you have for me as his dad and for his mother and younger brother? Best to you, Chris. So, Chris, thank you for writing in, and your letter, I applaud you for being that dad. Like, you're really being an awesome dad about this. And because there are some fathers out there that have made a very different decision than what you're making, and they've disowned and disavowed their children simply for who they are sexually attracted to and may happen to fall in love with. And it's kind of frightening. I suspect that your son is definitely going through some stuff, Chris. It is hard being a baby gay. It is it's very challenging. And obviously, you don't indicate what your ethnicity is. I suspect if he is a young man of color, there's a whole other layer of stuff that he's having to process. So I applaud you for wanting to be that dad that can be supportive of his son, no matter what. And the advice I would give to you is to be present for him. Let him know that you love him and that you're there if he has any questions. And I would even say to him, you know your child best, but I would kind of do what I like to say, play stupid, and say, son, I don't know if you're sexually active yet, but I know some stuff. I might be able to help you out, whether it's things with your body or relationship issues and the like. I'm here to answer any question you might have. Nothing is off limits, although certainly you can make me uncomfortable, but I'm here for you nonetheless. This is being uncomfortable is part of parenting sometimes. So if there is something you need to talk to old dad about, please talk to old dad about it. And that is a way of you basically saying to your son, like, hey, I know that you're more than likely having sex with someone who's not a woman, cis, or it could be a trans woman, could be a gender nonconforming femme or something else. I forget some of the language. I get it mixed up sometimes. I know femme is often used as a nice umbrella term for just female identifying, whether it's biological or not, but just femmes. And then you have cis women that identify as femmes as well. So hopefully I've gotten this right and I've not offended anyone or misinformed anyone. But Chris, you can basically talk to your son and say, hey, I don't know if you're sexually active, but if you are, I'm here to answer questions. I do want to make sure that you are protecting yourself. So if we need to get you, a vaccine for meningitis, if we need to get you, we can get you some vaccinations for Hep B, Hep A. I believe they have one for Hep C now. So if we need to get you together to go out there and live your life, please let me know. I'll go with you. If you ever contract an STD, I will take you to the doctor. I will take you to the clinic. We can talk about it. We don't have to talk about it. You can just say to me, Dad, I need you to take me to the hospital, or I need you to take me to the doctor, and we'll deal with it. That's a good way to be present for your son in that context, because he may need you at some point. And he may need the cool dad to just give him what he needs and not ask a lot of questions. And eventually he'll come talk to you about it, because you've already established that you are somewhere, you are a harbor that he can go to when life gets a little stormy. You're available to him. So you got to build that. And if you haven't built it already, now's a good time. And, it's leave it up to him to say, well, I am sexually active. And if he wants to play the pronoun game with you and not say or confirm or truly confirm who he's having sex with, that's his prerogative. But you're letting him know, I see you and I love you and I accept you. Okay, so Chris, definitely be patient. And, don't pull him out the closet. You can't pull him out until he's ready, even if you already know, even if his mother knows, which I'm sure she does. She's probably found some stuff in his room, whether by cleaning or just being that mom that's in his business. Y'all can't say anything to him about it, but you can talk in very general terms about being a young adult and the fact that kids are having sex much younger than they used to, that we know of now. I'm sure folks were fucking at 12 and 13 back in the day, too. We just didn't have the research to confirm it. But yeah, but Chris, definitely, congratulations to you on being a helpful, positive, and affirming father. Because there are some gentlemen out there that could take some notes on this. Maybe they know who they are, maybe they don't. A lot of them don't know who they are. But I applaud you. We here at the Sexual Healing Podcast applaud you. So now I'm going to move on to the next letter. Okay, we're at 1:10, so I'm just going to do one more. Do one more. Okay, so this one is kind, it's a little on the long side, so stick with me here. Okay, this one is from a gentleman I am calling Bruce, and this is, again, another really supportive dad, but this one's kind of wild, so here we go. Hey, Doc. My doctor came out as a butch lesbian to her mother and me a year ago. She's 17 now. We love and support her, but I'm concerned about her sexual habits. Her having sex is not the problem, but rather the amount of sex that she is having and the reputation that she's building around town is the problem. While she has not brought any young ladies home to meet us, I am aware of her body count. Okay, Dad, not the body count. And her tendency to love them and leave them. Who she learned that from, Daddy? But okay. In addition, her mother found her harness and strap on while putting some laundry in her room. Her mother doesn't want to approach her about it. I'm guessing that's a strap-on. But she is afraid that the strap-on, combined with her butch persona, might suggest that she wants to be a man instead of a woman. We'll get to that, Bruce. My wife is trying to get me to talk to her about it because she sees it more as a, quote, sex from a man's point of view, unquote, thing, rather than a mother and daughter discussing sex. I told my wife that it makes her uncomfortable to have a conversation about the strap-on with our daughter. Plus, I haven't shared the word on the street about our daughter running through a lot of young ladies. I'm guessing you haven't shared that with your wife. We are working to embrace the sex-positive thing, along with the reality that teenagers do have sex, and in parentheses he says, and sometimes lots of sex. Question, should I speak with my daughter about any of this stuff, or would doing so push her away? I want to keep the lines of communication open for our daughter because she's not yet an adult, and there are things about life that we want to make sure that she knows and understands. What is a good way to approach all of this? Thanks, Bruce. Okay, so Bruce, you got a lot going on here. I don't know how you finding out about your daughter's body count and that she might be a bit of a Lothario running around town and wearing these girls out and just leaving them crying. Because she ghosted him. I don't know. You got a little something on your hands there. However, Bruce, I think that the only thing you can really do about that particular issue is to really talk with your daughter about her ideas about relationships and does she have any questions? Any concerns? How does she approach a relationship? You can say to her, I am really curious, and I don't want to necessarily go out cruising with you picking up girls, but do you have your Mac down, so to speak? Are you able to approach young ladies that interest you and get conversations going with them? Are you having any trouble in that regard? Letting her know that you're there to answer questions if any arise, because the reality is both of you love women, and it's not to say that you guys are going to be sitting there talking about, oh yeah, I hit this and I strapped that out. I'm not saying that, but just this idea of how do you woo a woman? Now, she is a woman, and I'm pretty sure her Mac is tight. You're just trying to find a way to get a conversation going such that maybe she might say to you that she tends to love him and leave him. At which point, that's an opening for you to talk with her about the fact that that may not be the best way to go about things, or to at least be honest with the young ladies that she's dealing with so she doesn't get this really, really bad reputation about her. which she's already kind of building. Maybe she cares, maybe she doesn't. Now, the strap-on thing, just because a young lady has a strap-on does not mean she wants to be a man. The reality is she still has a pussy and it still likes to get pounded and stroked and get her walls worked on. Being a lesbian does not mean that you get to ignore your pussy and it no longer gets penetrated. It's about who's penetrating it. She doesn't want a man in there, but she does want something that was designed to stimulate her vagina. That would be a strap-on. Now, the fact that your daughter is wearing one basically means that she likes to put a fucking down, and maybe her stroke is real tough. Okay? Or maybe she has some questions, but she got a harness. I have to think she has some clue as to what she's doing. And there are, from what I understand from talking to some of the lesbians that I know, those ladies take care of one another. They help one another to grow and be like, okay, so girl, look. Are you an oral only girl? Are you a pillow princess? Are you a stone butch? Are you just a butch? Are you into fisting? Are you into this? Are you into leather? That stuff comes up in the process of maturing, but also if you're in the right circles, those questions are going to be asked of you, and they're helping her to develop her answers and to really uncover her authentic self. Basically, it seems to me that your daughter likes to fuck, likes to fuck, and she's probably rather good at it and getting better by the day. So it doesn't mean that she wants a penis. She's working with what she has. She's very happy with her vagina, perhaps. Maybe she doesn't. Maybe she does. At some point, she may identify as trans and say, you know what, I really do. I feel an affinity to my masculine aspect, and that's really who I am. That it's possible, but I think the strap-on alone does not say that. Please let your wife know that the strap-on is merely a sex toy. It is to be played with. Okay? And if the harness is kind of flimsy, Dad, I'm gonna need you to come up off a little money so she can go invest in a good one. Get her a good one. It's like, and also, I mean, because she's come out, you may want to say to her, are there any supplies that you need? And financially support her acquiring her supplies, dental dams and the like. I mean, you don't have to give her like $600 to go buy all these sex toys and vibrators, but you may want to make sure she has the proper tools to be fulfilled in that way if you want to be participatory on that level. Or what you can do is go get her a Visa gift card or something like that, or gift certificate to the local sex shop and present it and let her have at it. Because obviously she's investing money somewhere or somebody has bequeathed her a strap. But if you're going to have a strap, you got to have a collection. Because one of the great things about being a lesbian who likes to get penetrated by another woman, you can pick the dick you want. That day, that night, that morning, you can pick the dick you want. So your daughter needs options. So if you want to make sure that she is fulfilled and that she's happy, invest a few coins in her sex toy collection to make sure that she is dicking down the girls right. Certainly, you want to get some advice about how to communicate and, to get her thinking about who she's looking for and what she's looking for in a relationship, in a sex partner, and also how to end relationships. She may be kind of loving them and leaving them because she doesn't know how to end a relationship. That's not second nature. A lot of people struggle with that. So that might be an issue as well for her. Okay, let's see here. So I think that if you see your daughter heading down the wrong road, you've got to talk with her about it. But you don't want to sit down and be like, okay, so, let's say her name is Sharnice. Be like, Sharnice, I hear you out there hoeing hard. You just dicking the girls down and doing them all, just doing them any kind of way and not returning their calls, not returning their text messages. You got girls running around town and, I heard this one girl was out in front of our house surveilling the shit, waiting on you to come home. I ain't got time for that shit. That's probably not the best way to go unless you understand that that is what your daughter is going to hear. You may need to preface it, but maybe that's what she needs to hear. Be like, look, you out there doing too damn much. We cool with you, you know, being sexually active and exploring yourself and being free, and we're happy that you are happy in your own skin. We applaud that. We want that for you. However, respect this house. I don't want no crazy bitches running around here throwing shit through the windows. I do not want to hear about another young lady coming into so and so, and I'm hearing about how my daughter has fucked her down and is doing her any kind of way. I don't want to hear about that. So I need you to clean this shit up. You know, what, however you have to do that. But I think if confronting her too directly is not gonna be a good way to go, which it may not. Your daughter might be that one. It's just like, well, shit, that daddy, that's what it is. You know, these hoes. You know, she could be that girl. I don't know. She could be that girl. But just, you know, just say I want to have a want to have a conversation with you about, you know, relationships and all that. How are you doing? Are you having any problems? Do you have any questions? I know I'm your dad, so I might not be the coolest guy out there, but I did get your mama, and we did make you and you the shit. So maybe daddy got a little something he has to offer, you know, if you want to take a humorous approach like that. But check in with her. If you've built that kind of relationship with her already, she may actually talk with you about stuff. And again, as I advise many parents of LGBTQ children and teens and young adults, do not ask questions that you're not prepared to handle the answer to. There is a way of telling your child, I see you, I love you, I support you, but I really don't want to know all the details. There's a way to do that. You don't, the last thing you want to do is to make your child feel stigmatized from you of all people. It's not a good way to go. All right. Okay, so I think I'm gonna wrap up this week's show. This week was busy as hell. I was Monday was a struggle. And I was recovering from it yesterday, and I had a really long meeting that basically went from 9:30 to 6:30. It was long. So I came home and crashed, and I did not get a chance to watch Pose. So I'm going to give you a two for next week. We're going to talk about episodes 2 and 3. I will definitely be caught up by then, but I did hear that Pose has been renewed for a third season already. So I am guessing that the first episode not only received critical acclaim, but it also had strong viewership. So if you are part of Team Pose or Pose Nation, please give yourself a hand. And more importantly, keep watching. I'm going to be part of Team Pose this evening when I get home. Right now, I can't be part of Team Pose because I got to go get it together and head out to a meeting. But again, it has been an honor to chat with you this week. Hopefully, my story of my experiences with my father may be of help to you and kind of reflecting on your experiences and possibly how they may be impacting you in present day. Because the sad reality is, very few to none of us get through childhood unscathed. There's always something lurking to kind of cause us to question things and wonder, why me? What's wrong with me? So it's not necessarily you at this point. It's just, that's just life. All right. So that concludes episode 50 of the Sexual Healing Podcast. Hopefully you are using a hashtag sexual healing pod. If you have a question, comment, concern, so on and so forth, please reach out to me at sexualhealingpod@gmail.com. You can also reach out to me at Dr. Pookie on Twitter, DrPookuQuie. And I'll be continuing to promote the show. I'm trying to get it together. I'm trying to get my machine ready because it's some work, y'all. As Trilificent and I talked about a couple of weeks ago, podcasting is more than just sitting there and recording. It's editing. It's coming up with show topics. It's tracking down guests and trying to put together a show that's at least coherent and something that people can get through. So that is this week's show. Check us out on Facebook. It's Sexual Healing from Top to Bottom. And you can also check us out on Instagram at Sexual Healing Pod. I think that covers all the places you can find me and the show. And yeah, so we are a proud member of Pods by QPOC. That's a hashtag as well as a .com. Shout out to my brother Trilificent doing his thing over there with Flawless Noises with Candace and Jeremy. And if y'all aren't listening to Ratchet Ramblings and you watch reality shows, at least the Ratchet ones, y'all need to be watching Ratchet Ramblings because they just sit there and they cut up terribly. It's so wonderful. But okay, so that is going to conclude this week's show. Definitely be a blessing out there in them streets. And, well, you could be a blessing and a curse in the sheets, you know. You could just hit that spot just mercilessly. Which, you know, it's kind of fun, actually. I call it a seek and destroy. But that's just me and my horn dog and, you know, devious ways. But okay. So, that will conclude the show. Keep it sexy out there. Keep it healing. And if you have conversations that you need to have with people, go through your process. Uncover the dirt. Decide that it is dirt. And maybe it'll leave a little dust on you, maybe a few stains, but understand those stains as gifts, ultimately, and then go about doing your work to find the gift. What's the gift? What's the tool that came with it? How can you be a blessing to the people that have hurt you? Because it, love and hate, thin line. And then also, assess the outcomes, keep growing, because there's a lot of value in our past pains and hurts. And I think the real sad thing is when we actually experience those pains and hurts and traumas and we never discern the value in them. Alright, so do your work, y'all. Giving you my best, Ayanla. Do your work. Alright, and no foolishness. Not on my watch, but okay. I have no sense, and I probably should have had some wine while recording this one, but hey, I'm keeping it sober. Keeping it sober. All right, so y'all be good. Keep it sexy. Keep it healing at all times. Take care, y'all. Have a great week.